back at it for you on a Monday, March 23rd edition of Connecticut Today, keeping an eye on the coronavirus outbreak. Early in the show, we talked to a prominent Catholic journalist about how the coronavirus outbreak is affecting and maybe harming the Catholic Church. We checked in with defense analyst Brian Boyd in the 3 o'clock hour. How's the coronavirus affecting the readiness of the U.S. military? And then we aired live comments and remarks from Governor Ned Lamont and the state's chief epidemiologist, Dr. Matthew Carter. The Catholic Church and other faith-based organizations, other religions, they're going to take a hit from this coronavirus epidemic monetarily and tragically as far as lives go. And whatever, but the Catholic Church looks to be taking a particular hit as people are staying home, no money in the coffers, and there's been a human toll as well. We welcome back to the program. This is the third time we've had this gentleman on. He's a senior contributor to the Catholic News Agency, and he is executive editor of EWTN News. EWTN is the Catholic channel. You may have that on your cable provider, your online provider, your dish provider. Dr. Matthew Brunson joins us. Dr. Brunson, Paul here in Bridgeport again. How are you?
I'm very well. I hope that all of you are safe.
Well, we are, Doctor. We're trying, and the governor's clamping down on things a little more here in Connecticut tonight. So we will see if people pay attention to that. I read a story over the weekend from one of the wire services, Dr. Brunson, that when we come out of this, not if, you know, we're all optimistic here, there will be a light at the end of the tunnel here. The Catholic Church in particular going to be hit pretty hard by this, Dr. Brunson, particularly because, the coffers are not being filled. A lot of people are not able to go to services on Sunday or any time during the week. So it certainly is a time of challenge for the church, is it not?
It is, but it's also a time, I think, historically, when the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, the time before the Protestant Reformation, was very active in times of plagues and epidemics and pandemics. It's odd that in the 21st century we're talking about a pandemic, similar to what we've seen in history. But this is a time, I think, when we are starting to see some very creative responses on the part of the clergy in particular, with drive-through confessions, with streaming of masses. And I think what we found is that a lot of people who miss Mass desperately are really appreciating the fact now that they can't go, how important it is in their lives. So I think when this is done, I think we're going to see a lot of people very eager to return to Mass. And I think I'd be very shocked, regardless of the economic conditions in the U.S., if they're not very generous with their support of the church afterward.
Yeah, I did read over the weekend, Dr. Brunson, though, there are some areas, I know one spokesman from a New York diocese said, you know, the 190 churches in his diocese, you know, there will be some damage monetarily. And even the secondary thing, which I did not think of, Dr. Brunson, is how many organizations actually pay rent to the Catholic Church all over the country for things like, you know, preschools and nursery schools and things like that. That's something I did not realize. So all of that, as you say, is going to take several months to shake out here when we're done.
Absolutely. And this is one of the reasons why prudence is one of those virtues that the church always teaches. You know, we have the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, but we also have the cardinal virtues of fortitude, temperance, justice, and prudence. And this is where it's very important to be prudent right now, to put the safety and welfare, not just of Catholics, but of everyone in the forefront. That also means, though, that if we're worrying about their welfare, we also have to worry about their spiritual, emotional, and increasingly psychological well-being. And that's where I think the church is, not just the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church in particular, can play a very important role here in helping people get through the isolation and the anxiety and the fear that is understandably accompanying this pandemic.
You know, Dr. Brunson, some things happen like this, a pandemic or something smaller, maybe a regionalized disease outbreak or other things that happen, attacks like 9/11 or these major storms. And I don't think a person has to be particularly religious in any one religion There's kind of a universal notion here, Dr. Brunson, that when things like this happen, all the technological buzz-bang stuff we have and whiz-bang stuff, that all, even though it's useful in times like this, it all takes second place to knowing that there are things far more important and powerful that go on that we just have no control over.
That's absolutely correct. That we can have all the technology in the world, and it's going to be crucial, certainly in the medical field, to help cure this, to treat this, to overcome this. But you're right. This is a time when so much of our daily lives goes back to the basics. And how we are able to cope, I think, is one of those key determiners in how we're going to get through this crisis on an individual basis. And I think that's also where the churches can be very helpful. The other aspect, too, that I think the churches can provide is to use that technology. I always say that St. Paul, when he wrote his epistles, used a stylus, a parchment, and his sandals to communicate. Well, the churches today are using all their means of social communication. That's social media, that's online streaming, to help people in a real moment of crisis. So it's a necessary use of technology. But I'm glad that we have it, given where we are right now.
Dr. Matthew Brunson joins us, senior contributor to the Catholic News Agency, and he's the executive editor of EWTN News. Dr. Brunson, as we always suggest and talk about when you and I get together, Pope Francis, again, kind of breaking the mold. I saw there was some people that kind of winced the other day, and when the pontiff, I guess, left the Vatican, as he's known to do, and he went and went outside, and despite his age, in his early 80s, he went to celebrate Mass and visit some churches in the area.
Well, what he did was he visited two churches. One is the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore, or St. Mary Major, which is the oldest church dedicated to the Blessed Mother, the Virgin Mary. And the other was another church that housed a cross. Both churches, Santa Maria Maggiore houses what's called the Salus Populi Romani, which is an icon of the Blessed Mother and the infant Jesus. That has close ties to another pope, and that's Gregory I the Great, who in 593 was pope and dealing with a plague in Rome. It is said in some of the accounts that as many as 80 people would drop dead during just gatherings of people in Rome. That's how severe the plague was. And he led a procession through the streets of Rome in 593, and he marched the faithful all the way to the Mausoleum of Hadrian, and had a vision there of St. Michael the Archangel, which is exactly why anyone who visits Rome, you have the Castel San Angelo right on the Tiber. That's where it got its name. So Pope Francis, as popes often do, was going very old school in visiting and praying for the intercession of the Blessed Mother in a time of plague in exactly the same way that 1,500 years ago one of his predecessors did. So this is well worth, I think, his effort. And it's classic Pope Francis.
And while doing this, Dr. Brunson, he was literally pretty much at ground zero for a nation because of its older population and maybe its hesitancy to socially distance because of, you know, Italian heritage and the closeness of the family in times of trouble. I can attest to that. The Pope was looking at literally hundreds of people dying every day as he did this.
That's right. So for him, this was a prayerful act of trust and placing ourselves in trust to our Lord, that at a time like this, we can actually come together united in prayer. And the Pope has been very aggressive in his use of streaming and social media, asking people to pray together, to remember each other, but also to act responsibly. That's where that virtue of prudence comes in again, to respect the needs of the common good. And in this case, it's the idea of social distancing. It's not going to church for public masses. It's basically the church, once again, working with the culture to achieve the common good, as I said. But that's also part of being prudent.
And finally, Dr. Brunson, what do you make of some people, some theologians who say that if we look closely in Scripture, there are allusions to things like this. We always talk and hear of biblical prophecy. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you read through Scripture, there are many occasions where because of sinful humanity, mistakes happen, the plagues happen in a broken creation. I think we need to be very careful about succumbing to things like prophecies. And let's remember, as our Lord said, we know not the hour. So I think this is a case where we can rely on the help of medicine, but let's also rely on faithful teaching rather than acting out of fear in any way.
All right. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. He is the senior contributor to the Catholic News Agency. He is executive editor of EWTN News. It's Dr. Matthew Brunson. Check out EWTN if you have that on your cable system, your streaming system, or your satellite service, or go online and check them out. Dr. Brunson, thank you. Always great to talk to you, and we appreciate the time. Take care.
Anytime. Be safe.
As we continue here on Connecticut Today, Paul Pacelli here on WICC 600 and 95.9 The Fox, our continuing coronavirus coverage. What does this mean for America's military, America's intelligence gathering operations? Could it, will it severely cripple them, perhaps? Our next guest, we welcome back here to the program. He's been on with us a few times, 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst and counterterrorism specialist. His website is BoydIntelligence.com, B-O-Y-D, Intelligence.com. Brian Boyd is the guest. Brian, Paul here in Bridgeport. My friend, how are you?
I'm very good. Nice talking to you, Paul.
Well, you mentioned before we went on, first of all, you are in Florida, and what is going down there in the Sunshine State before we get to the military aspect of all this?
Well, our governors, like the rest of the governors, they've shut down the bars and the nightclubs, and they're asking the restaurants to operate at 50% level, but they just announced the closing of the beaches. Well, Florida is dependent on beaches, and so he's saying to all these spring breakers, go back north. So you're going to get a bunch of students coming back to Connecticut. I'd watch out.
Yeah, right. Brian, your major concern in this, we've consulted with you on various military and national security aspects before. Your concern is what the military may have as far as supplies are concerned, and also whether this will at all cripple the military and eat into its role as to its primary job of protecting us on the shores here and around the world as well.
Well, without picking on politics, the previous administration was depleting our military for a variety of reasons. And I got into giving speaking engagements on the history of special operations intelligence. The one thing good about the current administration under Trump is they have ramped up and built up our military. So if the paradox is, if any time in history we got caught up with this kind of a major need for defense production, we are better prepared today than we have been in the last 15 years. And that's a good thing. With the passage of the Defense Production Act, which has been invoked 20 or 30 times since the Korean War, it's a little bit like after World War II, everybody ramped up after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Everybody went to work, the private sector went to work, and we started changing production. And you're seeing that in the private sector now with these drug companies, with the production of 5 million masks and ventilators. So the military is in a very good position to support and help the issue. Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, was on earlier, I think, today, and he was talking about how we are ready and capable, and we're not depleting our interest in other areas of the world. So we're looking at more than just this one event. We have lots of areas of interest that could be taking advantage of our weakness or our pandemic right now. But we're in good shape, and Secretary Wilkie, the head of the VA, has made it very clear we're doing good. Mark Esper made the comment that our force is young and capable, which is good because they are least susceptible to this as the older generation is.
What about overseas, Brian Boyd? We have these numerous bases overseas. Obviously, some of these bases, some of these enlisted men and women are doing their jobs, you know, holding up their end of the bargain in some hot spots around the world.
Yeah, the question comes up about the troops stationed in northern Italy, troops stationed in South Korea. They have been pretty much self-contained. The order went out to them early on in this epidemic about lack of social interaction, lack of travel, telling them not to travel back and forth, and saying self-quarantine. I saw where Mark Esper was making a comment that on board some of the ships at sea, there's like 67 cases, but they've all been self-quarantined. And they're not any, it's not a bigger problem than I would suspect. I think there was one death in Oregon from the VA, but so far the soldiers and the sailors and the airmen and the Marines are protected, and they have protective equipment, much of which is now going to be put out to the public.
How does that, though, at all, Brian Boyd, does that, you think, put the enlisted men and women at somewhat of a risk if they're going to heed the call and hand over some of the equipment they have? Or is there enough of a surplus with the military, or do any of us actually know that?
Well, that's the whole point of the Defense Production Act that the president invoked. They're producing 5 million masks. They're not taking it from the inventory that the soldiers have. They're not giving up their protective equipment. And with the National Guard being called up in Arizona, Ohio, and some of the other states that are asking for the National Guard, they have enough protective equipment. But this Production Act is allowing the military to spend the money to provide it to the public. And that's where all the fast action is now taking place. You know, we have enough manpower, medical equipment, supplies. There's enough gloves and masks for personal protection. And with this money from the Defense Department and providing over to Homeland and Homeland Security some 5 million respirators and ventilators, that will solve the problem. So that's why it's exciting to see how well our country is coming together on this thing, both bipartisan and between federal, state, and local, and private industry, all working together to come to solve this problem. I've even seen some of the worst critics of this president complimenting him on how effectively his team is working together. And that, to me, is already phenomenal. Even the press is coming with it. I think that's a big change, don't you?
Absolutely. Brian Boyd is the guest, 30-plus year, professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, the website BoydIntelligence.com. We will conclude with Brian after we check traffic and weather together on WICC 695.9 The Fox. Back here on Connecticut Today, Paul Pacelli with you on WICC 695.9 The Fox, one of our go-to guys when it comes to all things military, Brian Boyd, 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst and counterterrorism specialist. A few more minutes with Brian, the website BoydIntelligence.com. Concerning how the coronavirus may affect readiness, Brian, you're down there in Florida, the home of U.S. Central Command. What have you heard around there, and is CENTCOM operating as it usually is?
Yeah, and again, I'm going to quote Secretary Esper, when he said that the military is already taking their normal precautions. They're wiping down services. They're reducing domestic travel. They're doing the social distancing even there. I have a daughter and two son-in-laws that are still in the service right now, and they're deployed to different places, and they're dealing with it on a regular basis. My daughter's in the cybersecurity business, so they're dealing with it from a most professional point of view. So I think we're doing well. I think if you would be interested in a little segue, a lot of people are asking me about why Italy has had the major problem.
Yeah.
And I want to make a point there. When you look at why Italy got to where they are today, their initial problem was when the Wuhan city came about. The intelligence services of Italy warned that it could go there, and that administration over there ignored the warning. And then on just before January 29th, when they had their first case, they then started to restrict travel. Well, President Trump had already restricted travel months before that from China, and he took a lot of criticism for it. But the paradox is, had the Italian government paid attention to their intelligence warnings and not ignored it, thinking it was just a China thing, they could have prevented the major problem. And the Italian Italian population is almost 25% over 65, and they didn't have enough ventilators or ICU beds. Mm-hmm. Plus, their idea of social distancing is opposite to their culture. And so there's a real lesson to learn. That's why Dr. Birch has been talking and looking at the success and the test coming out of Italy and South Korea to see if we can get ahead of the curve. They keep talking about flattening this curve.
Yeah.
They're trying to see what we can do to not get into that same issue. And this is where you have to sort of compliment President Trump mm-hmm. for getting out ahead of it despite the criticism, because he was talking to other world leaders long before our press was all hung up on how Americans were worried about it. So that's a good thing, and I want to give everybody a good prognosis. Our military is not myopic. We're not worried about just one thing. We look at multiple scenarios in multiple areas. These scenarios are already played out. Even when the president was briefed early on, he was briefed on what the possibility of a major epidemic would happen. But this is bigger and larger than anybody anticipated. And with the one thing that's good that's going to come out of it, since we didn't have a really good testing system or a system that was obsolete, we're going to have a whole new unique health system generate or germinate, no pun intended, out of this experience.
Brian, do you think that any of the bad actors here who more normally might give us trouble, you think any of them have any inkling to do anything now, or are they just going to sit back and realize that that would be a fool's gold at this point?
No, we still have very, very nasty people in the world who wish us harm. The issue of cybersecurity is something we need to really pay attention to, because as we're doing more of this stay at home and depending on teleconferencing and teledoc and all these things, that is going to make our cybersecurity systems vulnerable. So we have to be much more diligent on it. I think a couple of days ago there was a news piece where they thought somebody had hacked into the Homeland Security system or the VA, and they were aware of it and they defeated it. But you do have a lot of people on the intelligence community and the federal law enforcement community that are watching for these kind of things. So we always have to be diligent, because when we're kind of in this weakened state, we don't want our enemies to take advantage of it. I think Secretary Pompeo made a comment about the lack of transparency in China. And if they did this time, if another epidemic comes, they're going to do it again. So we should always be prepared for that kind of action. And the positive side is that with the Chinese becoming our major source of our pharmaceuticals, this is going to push it back to United States production.
Mm-hmm.
There were years ago, our production was out of Puerto Rico, and with past administrations of pushing that market to China, it caused a major issue of the economy in Puerto Rico. So this may really be a good thing in the long run, because we'll become less dependent on our overseas sources, much like we used to be with oil.
Good stuff. Brian Boyd, 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, former Green Beret, part of the leadership of the Joint Special Operations Command, which oversees Special Forces, SEAL Team 6, and Delta Force. He also served in the Departments of Justice, Defense, Treasury, and regularly appears on radio and TV all around the world discussing these types of things. The website, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian, thank you. Good luck and good health to you and your family members, and we appreciate the time.
All right. Stay safe, Paul. Thanks for the time.
Right here on WICC 600. Let's take you live now to a briefing from Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, as his Stay Home, Stay Safe initiative is set to kick in tonight at 8 o'clock.
One bit of good news, because Josh and I were on the horn on the phone yet again with all the leaders of the hospitals. Right now, it looks like the amount of time one spends in the ICU is maybe 2 weeks, where in China it tended to be 4 weeks. I'm looking for good news, and that may be one way that we can add a little bit of capacity to our ICUs. As we continue to think about capacity, we've been working with the hospitals, and there are three main buckets, again, where we're trying to focus. And we've tried to make some progress. I got to say, the hospitals have really are working at warp speed. Unfortunately, the virus is working at warp speed as well. But number one, we have to look at in terms of facilities. How can we get more beds? How can we get more space? And we've now prioritized 2,000 nursing home beds that we think over the next month or so would be made available for COVID-related infections as needed. We've got a couple of mobile field hospitals that have already or are about to be deployed, one in Danbury Hospital, the other right here at St. Francis Hospital. Working with our colleges, you know, a lot of the students left on fairly short notice, and we've got moving vans coming up to some of those dorms now. So we're beginning to prepare to clear out those dormitory rooms so they will be available as extra capacity for, you know, intermediate care patients once they're out of the hospital, out of the ICU. And, of course, we're beginning to negotiate with the hospitals as we try and find extra capacity. When you think about capacity, there are things we can control, things we don't control. And we're working really hard in terms of making sure we have the additional space and occupancy to deal with what we got to do. We've got the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm told it's going to be coming up in the near future. I'd love to see it. We were on the phone today with FEMA. I'd like to think that FEMA is going to put a little new energy behind the federal response. But, you know, rooms and facilities is only part of the solution, because that doesn't make any difference unless you have the equipment and the gear and the people necessary to take care of what you've got to do. And there, look, we're working hard. You know, Josh Jabal, DAS, a lot of his purchasing team is now devoted to going after PPE, the protective equipment we need, going after ventilators, chasing down sources and opportunities around the country and further afield than that. And if the federal government doesn't want to do this on a unified, centralized basis, Connecticut is now teaming with other purchasing from around the country as an association, so the states will go out and try and buy and source as much of the important PPE equipment as we can get, because we are running short. We're looking at ways that we'll be able to retrofit things like commercial ventilators and the such, so we can again increase a little bit of capacity as we need it. Some ventilators, maybe we can get two people as opposed to one and find a way to retrofit that so we can increase the capacity of ventilation, because that is so key to our folks, especially in and out of the ICU. We continue to press hard with the federal government. We're on the phone again today, all the governors with the Pence Task Force team. And I try and remind them at every chance I can that, you know, you look at the numbers in New York and say New York is going to get priority in terms of PPE and ventilators and masks. And I just urge them, don't think in terms of New York. Think in terms of the hot spots. Think in terms of where the COVID is most intense. And that is New York City, Westchester County, and Fairfield County. That is a hot spot region. And you ought to think of it in terms of prioritizing that region, not prioritizing one state over another. Another bit of good news, I think, as we try and expand capacity, a number of our hospitals have been really aggressive. Not doing any non-urgent surgeries. That has freed up 30 to 40% capacity in a few of our hospitals. I'd like to see that continued. And that's capacity in terms of beds, that's capacity in terms of nurses, and that's capacity in terms of gear. So that's really good news as we try and plan for what we did. Look, we asked the hospitals, we told the hospitals, we directed the hospitals, I want to see 50% increase in capacity. Show us how you're going to do it, you know, over the next 4 weeks. And we are getting there. And show me what you can do yourselves, not say I just need more from the federal government. That's the supply side of the equation. Obviously, the demand side of the equation is probably even more important. As you found, looking at experiences in different countries, anything we can do to flatten the curve makes an enormous difference. I'm not going to recite the things we've done in the past, but as you know, starting at 8 o'clock this evening, we're going to be closing those non-essential businesses. Those non-essential people don't have to go to work. And Connecticut and New York announced that on Friday. New Jersey announced their similar protocols the same day. Massachusetts announced it just today. And, I've got David Layman here. We can talk through essential and non-essential, but I do urge people to use their judgment. And I'm thinking about it in this way. I mean, why clothing and not hardware? And to me, a hardware store, you need a wrench, your pipe is burst, you got to fix it. That's an essential activity where you probably ought to be able to get access and you need it. Clothing, say, I think you can get that online. We're trying to do anything we can to discourage people from aggregating in big and small groups up and down Main Street. And that's part of what I was thinking about. You know, is 50 people is your max or 10 people is your max? Look, we've set a stage. It's 50 people. A lot of our towns have said smaller. It's 10 people. But just think realistically about it. Obviously, it's a big auditorium like we are here, and we're spread out. You know, 50 is an appropriate number. If you're in a small coffee shop and you're waiting in line, 5 may be too much. So I can try and dictate as much as I can in the order, but I urge you to use your common sense and do everything you can to stay out of groups, large and small. And if you're over 70, stay home. Beaches. I mean, I've seen a lot of folks are closing beaches and the such. And I understand. I've seen some of the crowds at the beaches at Greenwich Beach, not to mention down in Florida. I understand the need there. What I've asked Katie Dykes to do, who runs our state parks, is try and cap the number of cars going to our state parks. Let's get some volunteers to tell people to keep their social distance. I'm trying to do everything I can to make it possible for you to be able to take a short walk with your family outside as long as you know, keep your distance, as they say. Every town's going to figure this out in their own way, but I just wanted you to know how I thought about what we're trying to do. Senate still hasn't reached a resolution. They're going back and forth. Obviously, our economic response is in part impacted by how they want to go forward. I can tell you, our meeting with all the governors, they were united on one thing. Give the governors a block grant. Give the governors the opportunity to invest the money coming from the feds in the way that we know it's most applicable. You know, we would probably focus more on hospitals and less on cruise line bailouts. We know what we need in terms of unemployment compensation. We know what we need in terms of Medicaid expansion. We know those are the priorities we've got. I think the governors working closely with mayors and first selectmen, that's where the rubber meets the ground. And I hope that that's where the Senate ends up. Look, I'm so proud of Chris Murphy. He's pushing a bill right now. What small business, I come out of small business. I know the pain small business has. Their revenues are disappearing. They still got those fixed costs. And Senator Murphy is pushing a bill, which I really hope gets through, where there's a forgivable loan to small businesses that do not lay off people over the next 4 months or so. And that's just the type of thing that allows a small business to power through this COVID crisis. It gives us a better chance on the backside of this, you know, to hit the ground and get this economy back going again. And one last thought on thinking about the day after, because I've got an amazing group of people dealing with this crisis every day. But the day after, I still think about our kids. And I think about our kids, hundreds of thousands of kids who are at home missing what could be, you know, months of education. I know that we had said we'd probably have to make up our mind on the schools and maybe it'd be a couple of weeks. I regret to announce, I think we're going to push off that date where they could possibly open at the earliest to April 20th. And that made Miguel Cardona, our commissioner, and myself think, what can we do for these kids now? I do not want to lose a semester. And Jan Hockadel and I were at the Connecticut Partnership this morning. That's the partnership between the state and the Dalio Foundation. And really pleased that we've been able to negotiate 60,000 laptops for our high school students. 60,000 laptops at virtually no cost to the state of Connecticut. Laptops are going to mean that not just the suburban kids from wealthier areas, but all kids can have an access to online learning and education. You know, start with Khan Academy. Start with Google Classes. Start with a lot of free content that is out there right now. Doing everything you can to make sure this is not a lost semester, but an opportunity to reinvent yourselves and reinvent education. You know, Jan's been telling me how at high school as well as K through 12. The teachers are really seizing this opportunity. They're starting up, you know, town halls, telephone conferences with their students as a way to keep them engaged, keep them focused on what we've got to do. And that's what part of this announcement is with the 60,000 laptops. We're also working with Verizon and AT&T and Altice and Frontier and all the other cable providers because, and they've been incredible. They said, look, they are going to offer free Wi-Fi in their hotspots to anybody, whether you're a subscriber or not. They said they're going to lift the data caps with all the telecommuting going on right now, make this easier for young people to find this affordable. So not only do you have your laptop, but now you have your connectivity. And every day we're working on amazing content to bring education alive to you remotely. And they're going to be expanding internet access to some of those areas that probably don't have very good connectivity. We're not going to let this period be a loss for our kids. And so, you know, with that, I just want to say, working with the hospitals, working with small business, working with our mayors and first selectmen, working with the legislature on both sides of the aisle, working with each and every one of you, encouraging you to do the right thing, the sensible thing, use your judgment, stay home if in any way possible. We're going to get through this crisis. And we're thinking about the next day as well. Thank you, everybody.
Numbers, 415 positives, 10 deaths, 4,500 tested. What can we extrapolate from those numbers? What are they telling us?
Matt, go to the microphone. So is everyone going to hear a question?
The current numbers, 415 positive, 10 deaths, 4,500 tested. What are those numbers telling us? What can we extrapolate from that?
Hi, my name is Dr. Matthew Carter. I'm the state epidemiologist with the Connecticut Department of Public Health. As I've described before, we are actually only measuring the tip of an iceberg. And the real question is, that's the most seriously ill people, the people who are hospitalized, the people who've been tested. No one knows how big the iceberg is under the water, so we can only make estimates. I said last week that for every confirmed case that we have, there are hundreds of people out there. I would assume at this point, I think last week I used the term 3,000 to 6,000. I still think we're at least in the thousands range, because that's based on my experience, similar with what we would see with influenza at this time. It is expected that for planning purposes, the way I think about this, and in an average influenza season, which usually runs from October to April, 10 to 20% of our population gets sick. If we, and that's those numbers, if you do the math, are a lot of people in Connecticut will get sick during this first wave, we can expect the number of hospitalizations to run in the thousands, and the number of deaths will probably be much greater than what we see in an average flu season, which is somewhere between 300 and 600. But we're just at the beginning of this. The influenza may not be the perfect model because we've never had a coronavirus pandemic before. So we don't know for certain. A lot of people ask me to make predictions similar to what you said. I think at this point in time, it changes every day. It depends on the number of tests that are done, the criteria for testing that are done. But the one thing that continues to go up is the number of hospitalizations. It's important to remember that in Connecticut, we are at different places. It's called, you think of an epidemic as having a curve that goes way up and comes down. This is still the acceleration phase where it's accelerating. As the governor said, the number of cases will double every 3 to 5 days. And we'll be at a very different place a week from now. You've seen the events in New York City, how much has changed just in 2 weeks. And same for us. It was 2 weeks ago Friday, this past Friday night, that Governor and many of the staff here were standing in Danbury Hospital announcing their first case. So it's only been, 17 days? For many of us, it's hard to remember before that. At this point. So what's good in terms of right now, remember, the reason why we put in these measures, social distancing, mitigation measures, is to slow this down. And the reason we're slowing it down is so that we can prevent our healthcare system from being overwhelmed. That's the key. And I think the governor mentioned good numbers in terms of that, making beds available, space available for what we know is coming. We can't see it. It's in the distance. But more cases are coming, more hospitalizations are coming. And we want to make sure that for every person who needs to be in a hospital, who needs to have oxygen, maybe they need an intravenous line because they need fluids, we'll be able to find a bed and receive the treatment that you can only get in a hospital.